defense. Crush a corporation. Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurink, and from Harbor Strategic, John Selleck is zooming in with us today. Selleck, this is already my third Zoom call today. I'm becoming like a pro on this thing now.
You're the master.
Well, I don't know about that. I think everybody's becoming a master of this thing right now. Later in this podcast, we're going to be joined by Jamie Fitzpatrick, the president of Michigan Virtual, and the senior learning specialist over at Michigan Virtual, Emily Salia, and also Brian Kelly, the former lieutenant governor, state legislator, and now the president of the Small Business Association of Michigan, will be joining us to talk about how businesses should be taking advantage of these new federal loans that are available that are forgivable, and folks who are being negatively impacted by the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic can take advantage of some federal money. But first, we've got several political things that we want to touch on. Selleck, I wanted to first talk to you about the whole Whitmer for vice president thing. This thing is really getting serious. You just forwarded me a National Journal story that had Gretchen Whitmer mentioned in a short list with Amy Klobuchar and Kamala Harris. This is a real thing, isn't it, John?
It sure is. I've long felt and said that she would be on a list, a long list to begin with, because she is certainly a strong political talent. She's run the state for a year and done, by the public's account, a reasonably good job. And she's the governor of maybe the key swing state in the election. So all those things and more are going to put her on the list. But this virus pandemic crisis has been like rocket fuel for those who want to take advantage of the opportunity to look like leaders. And it's hard to argue that she hasn't done that.
So, John, did you see that the governor is on Joe Biden's podcast? Apparently, he's been doing a podcast now. This is his second episode. So for his second episode, he invited Gretchen Whitmer on. This is after she's been on The Daily Show. She was on Fox News this past Sunday. She was on a bunch of shows over the past weekend. Her national profile is through the roof right now.
Oh, it is. It is. And I'm not surprised that he chose her to be on the podcast or on the second edition. I remember, Michigan is one of the three states he has to, that the president has to continue to carry as he did last time, and that Biden has to win in order to defeat Donald Trump. So why not pick a leader in Michigan who's getting all sorts of national attention, who's being promoted practically by the president of the United States vis-a-vis his Twitter attacks? So why not pick her? Why not grab hold of the attention she's getting and try to get some of it himself?
The mantra that she's been continuously talking about here, whether it's on Fox News or on the Biden podcast, is about a national strategy, Selleck. Is that a message that is critical enough, or is it still being too critical to continue to hammer on what the Trump administration is doing or not doing in regards to the coronavirus?
Well, I think there's multiple layers of things going on here. Number one, she's the governor of Michigan, so she's got a job to do, as apparently she's said it so many times that's stuck in my head, that's her term. And all the governors have made clear, from California to Ohio to Illinois, they all need assistance, and they were wanting to work in partnership with the federal government, and that is working to varying levels of success according to each governor on how that's going. So she has that job to do, number one. And then number two, she says she's not playing politics at all. And even if we take that at face value, she's certainly helping Joe Biden carry out his political needs by appearing on the podcast, for example, today. So I think there's a lot of layers going on there. She probably has enough reason to be on all these shows just based on getting on the ground intel from what's happening in a hot spot like Detroit and Michigan. But certainly her making the claim that she's, or the pitch that she's going on to each show to say there needs to be a national strategy is another reason for her to go on all those shows. But certainly people like Biden and the other news sources that are out there like CNN and Fox and everyone else know that this controversy erupted between her and the president. And the bottom line is that sells clicks.
Yeah, it does click. And so people, and you know what, too? She is so good on television. She delivers well. She looks good on TV. She doesn't stammer. I mean, some governors do. And I mean, you could say that Snyder got better. He wasn't great at it. Engler wasn't great at it. But Whitmer is just very good. This is really her wheelhouse when it comes to talking to the public, relaying a message. And the networks love that. They want somebody on the screen that when people are skimming through the channel say, hey, wait a minute, who's that? What do they have to say? I mean, she's definitely someone that the networks want to have on.
Absolutely. I mean, we've said this before, I think, on the podcast. I mean, I've always thought that she was going to be on the vice presidential list for a lot of reasons, starting with the fact that it's Michigan and that she's a woman. It doesn't hurt. Obviously, Joe Biden made that a prerequisite. Good choice on his part. I've said all along, it's because she is a political talent. She's very good at this, and she's at her best. I remember this all the way back to when I was a staffer in the legislature, and she was leading the charge against us every day on the floor. She's at her best when there's a fight at hand. And like you said, she does a pretty good job of being calm at the same time she's wielding her bat, her proverbial bat.
Did you guys notice, I saw a Chad Livengood tweet over the weekend that Governor Whitmer is kind of changing her answer when asked about being the running mate for Joe Biden. Now, initially she said that she wasn't interested and she said it wouldn't be me. And now she told The Atlantic, well, I'll just say this. I am 15 months into my job as governor. I worked for 2 years to earn the opportunity to have this job, and no one could have ever anticipated that we would be here in this moment. I didn't go looking for the national spotlight. I know the most important thing, where I'm spending all my energy right now, is trying to help my frontline healthcare providers and trying to educate Michiganders so that we can slow the spread of COVID-19. I don't like being attacked in national news. I didn't go out of my way looking for all this conversation. I just know that I need assistance and I need to use my voice at every opportunity to try and highlight what's happening in Michigan so that I can help my nurses and doctors and respiratory therapists who are doing superhero work. John, that sounds like a kind of a different message than what we've heard before.
I think that's the sound of a door creaking open. Don't you?
Yeah, that's a
ever
good
so slightly, but it's creaking open.
The way I look at it, I think that's true. The way I've looked at it is all of her answers have essentially been non-answers. So I just put this as a different variation in the non-answer category, but it was the longest non-answer we've seen. And so that represents a change. Heck, there isn't a governor sitting in this country right now that didn't want to run for president. Or wouldn't jump at the chance to serve as vice president. So we can't really hold that against her. The thing that sticks out to me as a red flag in a way that we've never encountered is part of the reason that Governor Whitmer's national reputation has skyrocketed is because of the crisis that we're sitting in and because she is presenting herself as the face of the resistance movement against the virus. Here in Michigan, she's the one getting the job done. And the flip side is so then if she says, okay, well, now I should try to leave and run for vice president, that makes things difficult for her to say, well, I'll just hand this off to someone else. This isn't just another project. It's the life or death project. So I'm not sure how you handle that. I think I would not be surprised for her to figure out a way to handle that, but I think it's a significant issue. And it's an issue for Biden as well.
Turning the page here, another issue that the governor is going to have to address one way or the other is what to do about candidate petition signatures. April 21 is the deadline for congressional candidates, judges, and local officials to turn in signatures in order to make the August primary ballot. And right now, there is several congressional candidates and several judges who are scrambling to find out how are they going to get the signatures they need to make the ballot. And there's a couple different options. The Secretary of State has suggested maybe extending the signature collection deadline into May, which is when it used to be. Or she could do something like Governor Cuomo in New York and cut the number of signatures you need to 30%. Other candidates have suggested that she just eliminate the signature requirement altogether. You just have to show that you have been collecting some, so every Tom, Dick, and Harry doesn't get on the ballot. But Selleck, I wanted to get your opinion. What do you think the governor should do on this front, and what do you think she will do?
My sense, based on every other alteration she's made, to accommodate the crisis, including last night's executive order that seems to now just mean FOIA, is not something that gets responded to anytime soon. I would be shocked if she didn't try to extend or alter to make it easier to get on the ballot. I mean, me personally, I understand that in previous times when there's not a crisis, the rules are the rules, and we've seen candidates not make the ballot. In fact, the guy who I think Detroit and Michigan is lucky is running the city right now, Mike Duggan. Remember, he did not get on the ballot when he first ran for mayor. He had to win as a write-in. he took his medicine and got it done. But we simply aren't living in that same world. And you cannot have a democracy without candidates. That said, I don't think it can just be everybody can get on the ballot. They still have to have some kind of limitation or a date extension to get that work done. But it won't look good for candidates who did make the ballot to be making a big deal about how their opponents didn't make the ballot if it's essentially because nobody could get out and collect signatures.
And I know that some candidates are going about it through the mail. I actually just got a text from Peter Meyer, who's running in the 3rd Congressional District, asking if he could send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, for example. And he could send me a petition, and I could sign it, conceivably have my wife sign it, and sign myself as a circulator and mail it back. Now, of course, I don't live in the 3rd Congressional District, and I don't sign petitions. But these are the steps that candidates are having to find themselves take in order to get on the ballot. And John, I guess if you extend the petition signature deadline to May, you could still run into this same problem. You just make it easier, I suppose, to get all these things mailed out and then mailed back to you.
This is true, because we don't know how long this is going to last. So we could be wondering about qualifying for ballots well into the summer, which is kind of a pretty unique situation to have to face. So I don't know what the answer is, to be honest with you. You don't want to open up too much, because you could get ballot pollution pretty easily, I suspect. But you want to make sure democracy moves forward.
One other thing I wanted to address with you, Selleck, is the issue of fundraising during these times. Obviously, money is the mother's milk of politics, and you want to have more money than less when you're running a campaign, particularly in a competitive district. But when you're passing the hat around at a time when people are pinching pennies and may not even have a job, the public look isn't very good. So what do you do as a political candidate right now to try and raise some money?
I think the answer to that varies depending on how high level of an office you're running. I continue to get text messages from the Trump campaign and the Biden campaign. You know, I got texts the other day saying, hey, it's Joe. Got a minute? I think at that level, they're having a more comfortable time pursuing their funds. I think the closer you get to the local races, the tougher it's going to be for people to do that. And the state house is up for re-election this time around. They're already facing the challenge of going out and doing their bread and butter door-to-door campaigning. Going out and raising funds is going to be tougher, and being closer to the ground means you're closer to your donors, and you're going to hear more blowback from people depending on what way you do it. So tone is going to be massively huge on how that's done.
Yeah, because we did see Gary Peters and or the Democrats hammering on John James, John James hammering on Gary Peters. I mean, I think that's going to be a perennial thing. Going all the way up to November. But that is going to be an Achilles heel. If you're too aggressive on the fundraising standpoint, there is going to be some PR blowback, and folks at home are going to be scratching their heads thinking, God, you know, if I had a couple extra bucks, I don't know if I'd want to be giving it to you.
It's one more example of how the incumbents would seem to have an advantage over challengers in those races.
For both the petitions and obviously for fundraising and raising money. John Selleck from Harbor Strategic, thanks so much for being on the podcast. Joining us on the other end of the line is the president of the Small Business Association of Michigan and former lieutenant governor, Brian Calley. Good to see you, Brian.
Thanks very much. It's great to be back with you, or at least see you through my phone.
And it looks like you're still rocking the beard. The beard still looks good.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, about 3 weeks ago, when everybody kept on saying, wash your hands and don't touch your face, I took it very, very literally.
You know, my brother went the other way. He's had a goatee for the last 14 years. He decided to shave it off.
You know, but in these times when nothing is normal, I think everybody's just looking to just embrace that somehow. And I've noticed that people who didn't have beards are growing them, and people that had them are shaving them. So, hey, I guess just times are changing.
Control what you can control in these days.
Yeah, you know, I was saying to Paul W. this morning that, you know, when I heard his voice, I thought, man, there's nothing in my life that is like normal or regular compared to what it was a month ago. But just, you know, the sound of his voice is so recognizable. it's kind of comforting. Like, oh, that sounds normal. It's like this one little normal thing to start out my day today.
No, that's cool. Well, I'm glad that you're making part of your day joining us, because we want to talk about what's going on with business during these very unnormal times right now. And I know that there's legislators who are very anxious about the executive order that has us staying at home and staying safe. And from your perspective over at SBAM, do you believe that there are some businesses out there that can continue to operate safely while still adhering to the executive orders? And if so, what would those be?
Well, it's technically possible, but we've really shifted our attention and our focus in a couple of different directions, trying to relitigate or refight the battle on, you know, what's in and what's out. I think that's a futile discussion, and so we are just encouraging our members to fully comply with the governor's existing executive order. And we're starting to shift our attention now to looking to the future, whether it's 2 weeks or a month or 6 weeks or 2 months, whenever the crisis allows for us to ease off the restrictions and get back to work. What are the types of factors that will come into play? How do we do so? How do we roll back in, not unnecessarily delay, but not also do it in a way that risks a restart of high infection rates? So I think that's the place where we really need to spend time, is trying to build a consensus on how we open that door in the future, whether it's something that happens by May 1st or maybe June 1st, who knows? It's hard to say, but that's really where I think most of our focus ought to be today.
Talk a little bit about the, and we wrote about it on Friday, the work you're doing in terms of promoting the Protect Paychecks program. How much attention are you getting? What's the traffic you're seeing in terms of your webinars and in your website? And then what are you hearing from your members?
We launched a website on Friday. It's independent of SBAM, but we really were the ones who drove creating it. It was a really cool partnership with the Michigan Association of CPAs and the MEDC. Garland Gilchrist and I teamed up to launch and promote it. And even it was volunteer effort by the folks at Rocket Mortgage to actually do the website construction. So it was a really neat project that came together. But the purpose of it is to make sure that every single business knows about the Paycheck Protection Program. And so that site on day one, without any kind of promotion of it, just that earned media and a partnership network of about 120 different organizations sending it out all to their members, it saw traffic of 24,000 visits on the first day. And it didn't even launch until the second half of the day. So it's getting a lot of attention, and rightfully so, because this is a real lifeline to businesses. We just need the banks to continue to come online to overcome the administrative kinks and obstacles between the federal government implementation and the on-the-ground implementation of banks.
And this is basically connecting these small businesses with money that's available at the federal level to make sure that they're keeping their doors open during this time of mandated closures.
Exactly. The federal government appropriated $350 billion, which sounds like a lot. I mean, it is a lot, but when you consider that there are 22 million small businesses across the country, it will go fast. So we're saying to our members, do not delay. When you call your bank, they're going to be frustrated because rolling out a brand new, unprecedented federal program in 1 week, it's never really worked that way before. Definitely not with the federal SBA. So everybody's frustrated about what's being expected of them, but what we're trying to impress upon people is that every single day, more businesses close their doors for good, forever. And we have to be persistent. We have to be determined to persevere through all the challenge of rolling something out like this quickly, because the economic landscape that makes our community special and strong require that we do so.
When your members ask, how quickly do you think they'll start to see these loans be approved, to see these funds actually in their operating accounts, to be able to support their payroll?
Some of our members already have it. So we have been saying to our members starting in like in the very beginning of last week to call your bank. First of all, find out, are they an SBA lender? Are you going to participate in the Paycheck Protection Program? And if so, put me on your list. And even ahead of them having the rules on how to implement it. Some banks that are very experienced with SBA loans were able to just basically start up as soon as they had the rules available. But that's not most banks. Many of them hadn't made SBA loans in the last year. And so, get this, their password to the SBA system had expired. Oh, that was a lot of banks that had that problem. And ironically, and it tells you something about our federal government, they were having a hard time dealing with the volume of unlocking passwords for banks that that had expired passwords. I mean, something as simple, I say simple, nothing is simple in these times, but something as basic as that has created an obstacle to banks that otherwise are ready to participate in this program. And that means that their customers have to wait too. So we're trying to keep the heat on at the federal level, and then also encouraging our members to be patient, because every system is stressed right now, but also be persistent. Don't give up. Don't let off the gas. Keep at it. And we're seeing over the weekend, we already saw several banks start to roll into place. They started to send out approvals. We've asked our members, let us know when you get yours so we can keep track of how these things are progressing.
What do you tell businesses who see uncertainty all the way around, right, because of this virus? And then they think, well, why do I want to borrow money from the federal government that I'm going to have to pay back to take a risk to keep it open?
Well, that's the great thing about the Paycheck Protection Program, is that you don't have to pay it back. So it's done technically as a loan because the SBA is not allowed by law to give grants. But they are able to forgive loans, which means they are able to make a loan and then say, under certain circumstances, you don't ever have to pay it back. So the way this works is it says, we're going to lend you 250% of average monthly payroll. And as long as you keep your workforce whole and the number of people and the amount of pay and benefits you give them compared to how it was pre-COVID-19 crisis, as of February 15th is like the magic day. If you keep people whole as to what they were on that day, and then also spend the rest of the money just on rent, interest, or utilities, then the loan is forgiven. You don't have to pay it back. So this really will be a lifeline.
How many businesses you think are going to be saved because of this program?
Well, every business that gets access to it is put into a position that is far, far better than what they otherwise would have been. Because most businesses, even those that are critical infrastructure businesses, are experiencing a massive reduction in the overall amount of just cash flow. And it's resulted in record layoffs. I mean, the layoffs that you're seeing coming through right now are multiples higher than the worst time of the 2009 economic crisis that Michigan faced. It's difficult to imagine job losses rivaling 2009. And yet, not only does it rival, it's multiples higher. And that's in terms of the unemployment activity anyway, the unemployment claims activity. So this is this truly is an unprecedented time. And the answer is we really don't know. We just know that these businesses will be in a much better position to survive if they have payroll support over the next 2 months.
I wanted to also ask you, just taking off your SBAM hat on, but as somebody who has been a part of the legislative and executive branch, I wanted you to weigh in and give your opinion on this current situation where the House and the Senate are going to be coming in on Tuesday. And it's because they feel that they have a legal obligation to extend the governor's first emergency order that was issued on March 10. Now, the governor says that's not necessary because I rescinded that emergency executive order from which all other emergency orders originate on April 1. And so that one does not expire until April 29. So I get a new 28-day shot clock. You don't have to come into session on Tuesday continue an executive order that I've already rescinded and put out a new one on. As someone who's been a part of the legislative and executive branch, I wanted to get your opinion on this.
Well, there are conflicts in Michigan law when it comes to these things. And there's also relevant case law that could come into play if there's an ultimate showdown between the branches. But I sure hope that it does not come to that. The idea that the legislature has scaled back their activities to simply handling a single item in the statute that governs the declaration of emergencies and how they work, and then also taking what are really quite extraordinary measures in order to control the work environment for this limited activity, I think it's very reasonable that the legislature is saying that this one obligation they have, this one thing that they're supposed to do according to the act, that they're going to fulfill that obligation. It's, you know, I think people have been really hard on the legislature, and it's easy to beat up on the legislature. You know, it's kind of a nameless or a faceless entity to most of the public. But the fact of the matter is, the measures that the Speaker of the House put out yesterday are way, way beyond what most critical infrastructure entities are doing in terms of the controls to protect the workforce. So I think this is an area where they really are they're taking very reasonable and extremely limited steps in order to fulfill the obligations that they believe they have.
Brian Calley, he's the president of the Small Business Association of Michigan. Thanks so much for taking time with us this morning.
Thanks, John and Kyle.
All right, joining us this week for the podcast is the president of Michigan Virtual and the senior professional learning specialist for Michigan Virtual. It's Jamie Fitzpatrick and Emily Cecilia. Thank you both for appearing on our podcast this week.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Well, appropriately, since we're talking about Michigan Virtual and learning about things online, we are continuing with doing our MERS podcast interviews via Zoom, and that's what we're doing here today. And Jamie, where are you reporting from here today?
My home.
Just like everybody, right?
Everybody else.
Why don't you give our listeners, first of all, a little briefing on Michigan Virtual. Who are you and what do you guys do?
Sure. We're a nonprofit organization created back in 1998, initially to help with some workforce development issues that existed back in the latter part of the 90s. In 2000, we were asked by the governor and the legislature to create a virtual school. Around 2004, we got out of workforce development and really focused the organization, Kyle, on K-12 education. So for all of those years, we have been focused really on providing online courses to primarily high school students, but some middle school opportunities, and professional development that's delivered online to teachers and bus drivers and food service workers, really anybody who works in the K-12 space. And then for the last 6 years or so, we've operated the Michigan Virtual Learning Research Institute, which is a small group of people in our organization that are really focused on trying to identify best practices as it relates to online and blended learning.
And so who utilizes Michigan Virtual then? Who's give me an example of somebody who would use Michigan Virtual to their benefit?
So on the student side, last year we delivered around 30,000 semester length courses. Those courses entailed an opportunity for kids who maybe wanted to take an advanced placement course, as an example. We know right now about 40% of Michigan's high schools don't offer a single AP course. Give kids a chance to prep for the College Board exam and save mom and dad some tuition costs by earning college credit before they graduate from high school. It might be a situation where a student had an academic failure and they are looking for credit recovery opportunity. Oftentimes, it's just simply their scheduling doesn't work out and they want to take Spanish 3. And it's only offered in a small school, maybe every other spring. So a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's a health issue. So that's on the student side. On the educator professional development side, last year we delivered over 250,000 hours of professional development to the K-12 community. And that's everything from compliance kind of courses like the dangers of bloodborne pathogens all the way to how to do a better job of teaching students math or how to read, and that are tied to, you know, very specific curricular activities.
So what is participation levels been like for Michigan Virtual over the last few years?
Well, it's continually increased as online learning has increased. Michigan has a policy framework that has been fairly open to online learning. We're one of the first states to have a state virtual school. Around 2012, Michigan gave a green light from a policy perspective to have charter schools that were delivering all of their services online. We're a supplemental provider, so the students that we serve are typically connected to a private, nonprofit, parochial school or a public school. In some cases, they're homeschooled. But 99% of the kids that we serve are attending a school, and we're supplementing their educational opportunity with an online course that the district has basically engaged us to provide with a highly qualified Michigan teacher. But that policy framework has been fairly substantial as it relates to the other states around the country. So in addition to allowing cyber schools to operate in the state and having a state virtual school, we've seen an increase significantly in private sector providers, but Michigan actually has a fairly significant history from a national perspective. We were the first state in the country when the governor and the state board and the Department of Ed revamped the high school graduation requirements back in 2006. Michigan became the first state to require an online learning experience as a condition of graduating from a Michigan's high school. And that could be met in a number of ways. But so we do have a pretty significant history as a state in giving students an opportunity to learn in a venue that's not predicated on a fixed classroom in a traditional school setting.
So as we're going into this new executive order where the school buildings will be closed, but schools are going to have to come up with some sort of plan to provide a virtual learning or distance learning opportunity, is there anything that you could offer school districts as they're embarking on their plan?
And I would just draw some distinction between what we do in terms of delivering online courses with highly trained educators who are using a structured online password protected learning management system, a very robust learning environment, with what schools are attempting to do, at least the vast majority of them. I would refer to that not as online learning, but really as kind of emergency remote learning options. And some of that is going to be delivering packets to kids that don't have access to the internet. Some of it's going to be just phone calls. So it's going to be low tech, but hopefully it's high touch. I would suggest that the things that parents and schools really need to be thinking about is just starting small. This virus has been a shock to the system in terms of shutting down our schools. Teachers are not used to delivering their services to kids at home. Student engagement is always an issue, and I think it even becomes more of a challenge when kids are at home and dealing with the stress of parents maybe being laid off. So start small, build on successes, rely on the teachers in your community that have been doing some of this technology, remote learning for a period of time. Set and manage expectations. If there's school leaders that are expecting a teacher that's going to develop a fully online course in a couple of days or a week or so, that's not realistic. And I think the last thing I would suggest is that we're living in some really difficult time right now, and we need to take care of each other and deal with the emotional, mental health side of things. And that's something I think our students desperately need.
Emily, Cecilia, you're a senior professional learning specialist. Tell our listeners what you do for Virtual Michigan or Michigan Virtual.
Sure. So I work with teachers both online and face-to-face with intentional technology integration and personalized learning. So we have, as Jamie mentioned, we have courses that I help facilitate, as well as blended learning experiences where some of our content and interaction is online and then some of it is face-to-face, so blending the face-to-face and the digital format. And then some of it is fully face-to-face. We do, we offer lots of professional development days for different districts, as well as we've also done cohort learning and service districts for hours of coaching.
So how successful can online learning be? I mean, can it be a real replacement for that face-to-face contact?
I think when it's not going to be the same. It's going to be a very different experience. And I want to go back to what Jamie said. that what some of the services that our teachers offer is a very robust and a very deliberate experience, where right from the get-go, it's understood that you won't be seeing students in a face-to-face setting. So there are things put in there to build community and to interact with the teacher and the student. And then there's also a mentor piece in there too. So I think that's very different than what teachers are being asked to do right now. And so it's possible, for sure. It's not going to replace that face-to-face experience though, but it can attempt to replicate it in some form.
So for teachers who have never done this before, what advice would you give them?
Again, I'm going to build on what Jamie said and starting with what you already know and what you already do. These are scary times. And so sticking with something that's familiar for you as a teacher and for your students and your parents. So if there's already a mechanism in place of how you connect with your families and your students, starting there. And then, and even if it's just an email, if that's how you connect with your families and your students, use that and build on that. I think keeping things as simple as possible and understanding your students' needs and access to resources is really important. And if they, and also utilizing offline activities, right? Reading and writing and outdoor exercises and things like that. Okay. Really utilizing those offline activities as well.
Emily, I think some of the concern is that students are going to be missing out on learning during this critical time. How much learning do you think can really take place between now and the traditional end of the school year in early June?
I think for sure students can continue to move forward and build on the skills that they already have. I do think it's unrealistic to think that they will fully get, you know, another 2.5 months of learning as they would in the face-to-face setting. But I definitely think students can move forward and advance on their skills. I think also this is an opportunity for teachers to try maybe some new things and maybe do a little bit of personalized learning where they can tailor some of their activities and their lessons and assessments towards where students are and bringing them forward to where we need them to be.
Do you have any warnings for educators or administrators at this time as they're kind of jumping into this whole new distance learning thing if they haven't done it before?
I don't know if warnings are the word I would use, but I definitely think going back to starting with what's familiar and keeping things simple, and then most importantly, giving grace to your students and to your families, and probably most importantly to yourself. This is new for everybody. Everybody's learning how to do this, and maybe even letting your students know that you're learning right along with them. These things, I think, is really important just for them to see you as a learner is really, really helpful.
And I don't know if this is better for Emily or Jamie. And one last thing I wanted to particularly ask about is the development of these plans that schools and school districts are going to be putting together. Is there anything in particular that the school districts should be keeping in mind as they're putting these together?
Well, Kyle, I think it's abundantly clear, just like we know that every district is not the same. Every district has different resources, has obviously you can think of, you know, the rural parts of our state with different resources and different access to technology are going to be very, very different than some of our suburban districts. I guess the biggest advice that I would have is that if, as people who are not experienced in this realm, if they're trying to push too fast and think that they're going to take everything and push it online and try to just simply replicate a traditional classroom environment, so none of us, and we work in this space, none of us would think that it would be healthy or appropriate for a child to be in front of a computer for 6-7 hours a day. So we have to recognize that some of it could be pushed online, but it just wouldn't be appropriate. And so I think they can't think about just trying to replicate, okay, well, Billy goes to first hour, he has math for 40 minutes, and then we do this for, you know, it's not going to be a one for one. We have to think about different kinds of scheduling for our kids.
All right. Any other thoughts on this topic, Jamie?
Just that we know how much stress this is creating for everyone, and that we need to be concerned for our students' continued access to educational services, but a big part of that has to be the social, emotional, you know, mental health. So I think Emily talked about the importance of the relationships and recognizing that, and that's, it comes natural for teachers that, but we all need to recognize that this is a really difficult time for them and we need to support them.
And any closing thoughts from you, Emily?
I think Jamie did a great job of summarizing.
Well, excellent. Well, I want to thank you both for being on the MERS Monday podcast. Emily Cecilia, the Senior Professional Learning Specialist for Michigan Virtual, and Jamie Fitzpatrick, the President of Michigan Virtual. Thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. I want to give a thanks to Brian Calley from the Small Business Association, also Jamie Fitzpatrick and Emily Cecilia from the Michigan Virtual Shop, and of course the boss, John Ruhrink. AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.